Okay. There's less people than before, and that means some people have died in the process. It's like gone. That's good. I hope you enjoyed that. One of the, your talk about, you know, using death as a contemplation to help you in meditation practice. And this is the kind of the idea. If you really get the idea of death, it's an idea of letting go. Yeah, you have to let go of everything when you're going to die. And you want to use that idea now. Don't have to wait till you actually die. Use it in this life to help you to unburden some of the things. And then you can get into your meditation much quicker. Yeah? You don't have to go through this whole process. Sometimes you just have to remember, I'm going to die. Bang. You just let go because you know the consequences of dying. Yeah? Anyway, let's go on to the questions for tonight and see what we have. In Theravada Buddhism, people believe in reciting or practicing Satta Sambhujanga and can cure sickness. I once thought it could be mainly psychological effect, i.e. the sickness is not cured physically, but only that the sick person is not bothered by sickness anymore. However, in Burma, there is a famous meditation master, a lot of people go to him to have their incurable diseases cured. Well, if they can cure it, it can't be curable, so that's already a problem. Anyway, his trick is to ask people to sit still for an hour. If they can do that, he will ask them to sit still for 2 hours. If they can do that, then for 3 hours, up to the point that they have the disease cured. Uh-huh, okay. Very interesting, yes. Is there an explanation for such a phenomenon? Why, by enduring severe pain, can cure serious illness? Has this to do with the Sambhujanga? Okay, I've never heard of this before. Now, this is very strange. Maybe he's just very lucky. Yeah, maybe those people who sat for so many hours, maybe they were kind of getting cured anyway. So he was kind of lucky, and he was whatever. It sounds to me to be very. Sounds to me a bit random, to be honest. I think the point is that if you are able to sit still for so long, it probably means that maybe you have some potential for samadhi, for metta, for all of these good qualities, and that may be actually what cures you. The fact that, not the fact that you sit still for 3 hours, but the fact that you have an ability in meditation already. That might be it. Because as I mentioned the other day, if you have a positive attitude towards your illness, far more likely you will be cured than if you have a negative attitude. Yeah? So I would reckon it's connected to that. But I would also say that the chances that this monk is going to be successful every time is zero. There will be times when it is not cured. Yeah? You never hear about those instances. The only times you hear about it, the one gets cured. Because those people come back. Those people don't get cured, never come back again. So you never hear from them. This is kind of this bias that we have in the world. Yeah, you only hear about those cases that work. Those cases that don't work, you never hear about. So it's very, you know, it's not exactly a very scientific way of doing things this way here. It's a bit kind of a bit dubious. Anyway, still there might be something to it. It is interesting, however, that in the suttas, there's a few suttas where they use the 7 Purjangas to actually cure illness. And one of the suttas is the Buddha himself. It's very, very strange, right? The Buddha himself is ill. And he says to Venerable Mahachunda, Mahachunda is one of the great arahants, supposedly a brother of Venerable Sariputta, and he says to Venerable Mahachunda, please recite the 7 Purjangas. And so Mahachunda recites the 7 Purjangas, and the Buddha is free from illness. That kind of strange. Why doesn't the Buddha just do it himself? Why does he ask somebody else to do it? What's going on here? And I think that, I don't know, but I think the point is that even the Buddha, if he gets very ill, he loses his energy. And when you lose your energy, you can't really recite these things maybe quite in the same way. So he gets one of the other arahants to recite these things in a powerful way. And then when he is reminded of the Bodhanga, the energy comes back in the mind, and when the energy comes back in the mind, that's the energy that matters, then the illness kind of is dissipated through the mental energy. Perhaps something like that. Yeah, even the Buddha probably loses some of his mental energy when he gets very ill. He needs a little bit of support to get it back again. You probably could cure it yourself, but maybe this is an easier way of doing it. Maybe it's just an example of how the monks and the nuns and the lay people should help each other to come out of illness, perhaps. But I think it shows you the power of mental energy, because if you are fully enlightened, you really understand what these Buddhas are. They are about awakening, they are about something very powerful. And when you hear that, you get really inspired. The energy comes out, inspirational energy. You kind of just dispel the illness very quickly. Something like that. And of course, these days, when the Theravada monks and nuns, maybe as well, go to hospitals, you do recite the seven Buddhas, yeah, very helpful. You recite them as well, then. You do? Okay, so we all do that. But the difference is that I do sometimes as well, but I haven't done it for quite a while now. But the problem is that these days we don't understand Pali. Yeah, in those days, they understood it. We do the seven Bodhisattvas, everybody speaks the same language, everybody understands. Now you go to hospital, you recite it, they haven't got a clue what you're talking about. So there's a big difference, yeah, because when you understand, it's very inspiring, but if you don't understand, all you hear is gobbledygook, okay, whatever, it's a different. So somehow we have retained the ritual without the meaning. This is kind of slightly problematic. But still, I think one of the things is that when you go to hospital and you visit somebody, sometimes just the fact that you are there, that you are kind, that you are caring, that you do something nice, sometimes that is enough, yeah? It doesn't matter so much for the meaning. But in those days, the meaning was what was significant. So there's a difference there. It shows you how things tend to deteriorate in Buddhism over time. Things that once had meaning, long time ago they had meaning, now they have become rituals. This is a very typical thing that happens in Buddhism. Things start with meaning, they deteriorate to rituals. And you see that throughout Buddhism, everywhere. Come to Bodhidharma Monastery, we do it too. I feel a little bit bad about that. I'd like to have less rituals and more meaning, but I guess sometimes a little bit of rituals is okay. But still, you know, it's a much more important to have meaning than to have rituals. Anyway, let's move on to the next question. Buddhism talks about nothing inherently existing. However, you talk about the world is inherently problematic. Isn't there some contradiction here? If the world is inherently problematic, then there is no way out. What is the point for all the practices? What are we doing now? Okay, so there's two different things here. Inherently problematic precisely because nothing inherently exists. That is the reason why it is inherently problematic. These are two sides of the same coin. If something inherently exists, if something is there, if there is a core to things, if you have a sense of self inside, if there is an aspect of you that is permanent, that aspect is something that you can find refuge in. That is an aspect you can take to be your real self, and you can find happiness there. Yeah? If there is a soul inside of you, a permanent entity that is there, that is where you can find your refuge. And you can just discard all the problems, all the suffering, all the impermanent things, and you can grasp hold of this thing which is permanent inside of you. But the fact that there is nothing that is inherently existing, there's nothing you can grasp hold of, everything is just a flux. Everything is always moving, everything is always changing. That is precisely why the world is problematic all the time. So you have to, there's two different issues here. One is that there is nothing permanent in phenomena. Another thing is the description of these phenomena as impermanent. Yeah? The description and the reality. That description, understanding of it as impermanent, that is why it is problematic. If you look at the world, it is always changing. Yeah? If you look at the world over long periods of time, people never find any final solution. There is no final solution to problems. And one of the reasons why there is a final solution is because human beings, we all have a greed and desire and anger and delusions in our heart, and we always try to distort society around us to satisfy this greed and hatred. So any kind of solution is always going to be permanent, because someone is going to come and distort it and try to use that society to their advantage. And you can see that in the history of the world, we have all these ideologies, all these utopias, the communist utopia, the capitalist utopia, whatever they are, the democratic utopia. And every time we try to build a society based on one of these ideologies, straight away greed and hatred comes in and starts to distort it. And this is why the communism has never really worked in the world. It has never worked because as soon as it is there, someone grabs hold of the power, and someone becomes greedy, and they use that system for their own gratification. The same thing with the capitalist system. Capitalist system as well. As soon as you have kind of a system in place, the kind of powerful beings, powerful corporations, powerful whatever, they kind of start to lobby and distort the system and take advantage of the system as it is. Same thing with democracy. As soon as you think you have a nice democracy going, these strong forces of human beings start to undermine democratic systems. So there is no stable society. There is no solution to these things. They're always being undermined by these powerful forces in the world. So everything is always in flux. Everything is always changing. There's nothing you can hold on to. You never know where it's going to go. And this is why it's problematic. Think about it. As I said before, don't take my word for it. Look at human history, look at these things, and I think you will realize that it is problematic. It doesn't mean that we should do anything. By all means, try to do something. When there are problems, when there is climate change, then try, let's all act together to the best of our ability to mitigate these problems of climate change. So it doesn't happen. It's not as bad as it could be. Let's do it out of compassion. Do it out of compassion for future generations, out of kindness for the world. And when you do it in that way, at the very least, you're making good karma because you're doing something good. If that doesn't work out, so be it. Then we are optimizing the chances of helping the world. At the same time, we're also building good karma inside of ourselves. That is the best way of doing it. But don't be too attached to the outcome. Because if you're too attached to the outcome, very likely you will be disappointed. Because the outcome is unpredictable. You don't know where it's going to go. You don't know what's going to happen. Okay, so I hope that makes sense. And let's go on to the next one. Okay, as a Buddhist, how can we convince ourselves to be content and keep quiet? How can we keep a balanced and calm mind? When the saying goes, the wicked man is so arrogant because the good guys don't speak out. Please advise. I started on the wrong side of the page. Let's go to the other side first. Okay. When seeing the police spraying pepper spray to the face of a man and a lady who just walked out of the MTR without doing anything, in the face of such a tyrannical government and provocative violent act of the Hong Kong police, who having the aim to intimidate people to speak up and to provoke people to resist with an eye for an eye, so that they don't even need an excuse to wipe out the protesters blatantly and send them to jail, with a so-called good reason. Okay. So, as a Buddhist, how can we, that comes the question, as a Buddhist, how can we convince ourselves to be content and keep quiet? So this is why this is such a powerful moment in Hong Kong, because of these problems, because people take opposite sides of this thing. Some people are more supportive of the government, some people are more supportive of the protests, and you divide society, you have all these problems. So we need to stand back and go above this. We cannot, if you allow yourself to be too sidetracked by this, you may agree with one side or the other, that's fine, But remember that we're dealing with human beings here. All of these are human beings, and everyone wants to be happy. Even these police officers who kind of maybe, probably they sometimes they overstep the mark, everybody oversteps the mark sometimes, and if you are in a powerful position as the police, probably it's quite easy to sometimes overstep the mark. But remember, they're human beings. They do want to be happy. They are deluded. They don't really know what they're doing sometimes. The same thing with the protesters. The protesters go too far. They get too angry and upset. Yeah? And they do think that when they're wrong, they might regret it. Everyone really wants to be happy. We're all deluded. We're all slightly in darkness. And when you remember that actually they do this because they want to be happy, not because they want to suffer, but they're going the wrong way about it. Have compassion for them all. Have compassion for everybody. Nobody knows what they're doing. That is the right way of looking at this. And if these are worldly problems, there is no solution to them. There may not be a solution to this. Yeah. What is the solution in Hong Kong? Nobody knows. Maybe there is a solution, maybe there isn't. Quite likely there isn't. And if there isn't, all you have to do is you have to have compassion for everyone involved. It's the only way to look at this. Everyone thinks their way is right. Everyone thinks what they are doing is appropriate. And you may agree, disagree completely, that the other side has any clue as to what they're doing. But still, that's where they're coming from. So this is just a very powerful moment for spiritual growth, because of the dukkha, because of the suffering inherent in this. This is how you learn about the world. The world being problematic. The way to keep calm is to stand back a little bit. Don't allow yourself to be immersed in this too much. Don't watch the news all the time. Stand back a little bit. Reflect a little bit. If you allow yourself to be almost like a sore, that you don't leave the sore alone, you kind of always keeps bad, always more pus coming out. Sometimes you need to stand back a little bit to remind yourself to be calm, to remember the bigger picture, not to allow yourself to be dragged into this. Otherwise, you will never be able to see this in a balanced way. So I can certainly appreciate why people get very upset. Anger is very easy to get upset with these things. But really, this is the time when the spiritual practice really becomes powerful, because you understand the limitations of the world. The world really is problematic. That's what we're seeing now, in a deeper sense than normal. But take it as a learning opportunity. Every time we see a problem as a learning opportunity, you can grow instead of allowing yourself to be dragged down by these things. It's easy to say, but it works. This is the point. And it may take time before it really works. You may think that this is very idealistic. But it's not just idealistic. It actually works. If you keep on doing this, gradually you extricate yourself from the world, the problems. You still do what you think is right. You do it with a good heart. But you don't do it with the same kind of ill will and negativity. So then you can keep calm. You can keep cool. And that is the kind of people who can find solutions in a problematic world. Those who are cool and calm, and who can talk to the opposite side and come to a reasonable solution. If everyone is unreasonable, there's no solution. If everyone is angry, how can you speak rationally to an angry person? It's impossible. I'm not going to listen to you. Everyone needs to be cooled down. Sit around the table. Talk about things. Maybe there is a solution. Maybe there isn't. Who knows? At least it's worthwhile trying. So this is the way it is, and always remember that the other side, they also think they are right, they think they know what they're doing, maybe they're completely wrong, but they still think they're right. So because they think they're right, you have to kind of deal with the position, deal with things from that point of view, because they're trying to do the right thing. And even though they are very well being deluded about things. Sometimes you hear about these suicide bombers in the world. And we in Hong Kong, we are probably far away from the suicide bombers, but they too think they're doing the right thing. Even though, obviously, from Buddhist point of view, they're not doing the right thing at all. So because of that, you have to talk to them from that point of view. Listen, are you sure this is such a good idea to go around bombing people? Maybe not such a good idea. Maybe we can find a different solution to this. And maybe you can. Anyway, so good luck. It is not easy, yeah, but that is really what it sort of comes down to now. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmadi, thank you very much for sharing your insights with us the past few days. I'm deeply grateful. Would you mind sharing what a typical day is like for you at Bodhidharma Monastery? Typical day at a monastery? Incredibly boring, yeah? Oh, so boring. You sit with your legs crossed, you watch your breath, you can't get much more boring. Very kind of simple day. The typical day is that you get up in the morning at a suitable time, yeah? It's interesting that monks vary enormously. Some of the monks get up at 2 a.m. or 1 a.m. Yeah, because they like to meditate at night, and other ones are more kind of not so, not quite as bright in the morning, so maybe they get up at 5 a.m. Yeah, somewhere between 1 and 5 a.m. the monks will kind of get up, and we do some meditation in the morning, and normally we have breakfast, so we have some breakfast, and we have some work duties to keep the monastery going. This is kind of our opportunity to make some good merit by doing some building work and doing various kind of things that are required by the government or whatever. And then we have lunch, midday, lots of people come to our monastery. It's one of those very inspiring things to come to our monastery and see all the people who come there. On an ordinary day, 30, 40 people come to the monastery. On the weekend, 100, 200 people come to the monastery sometimes. Large crowds of people, and they come from everywhere in the world. This is one of the things I really love about a monastery, is that we have such a broad background of people. Some have a Sri Lankan background, the other immigrated from Sri Lanka. A lot have a Chinese background. They come in different parts of, you know, whether they come from Malaysia, Singapore, Hong Kong, or mainland China, many different backgrounds. We have people from Burmese background, people with a Vietnamese background, or, you know, white people, people from a kind of Anglo-Australian background, and a few with Korean background, a few with Japanese background, Cambodian background, some with Laotian background, Bhutanese. We have Bhutanese people coming to the monastery. There's quite a large Bhutanese community living in Perth. Nepalese background, the Indians, yeah, who have become Buddhists. One of our monks is an Indian monk. Yeah, he came to Australia for completely different reasons. He started to meditate and suddenly became a monk. He was a Sikh. He was a Sikh when he came to Australia, wearing a turban originally. Now he had a shaved head instead. That's what happens. So it's very inspiring. One of the things I really find is so beautiful is that we all work together very nicely most of the time. No community is perfect. Every community has their arguments every now and again, but most of the time we work together really well, even though this incredible diversity in background. The majority of Buddhist centers around the world tend to have one group of people together. You know, the Chinese people go to the Chinese Mahayana temple, the Sri Lankans go to the Sri Lankan temple, the Thai, that's not the Thais by the way, the Thais go to the Thai temple, the Westerners, they go to the Vipassana center, yeah? That's what most Westerners do. So we're so divided and spread out, and we don't really work together. Why can't we work together? If we're all Buddhists, we all take the Buddha as our teacher, surely we should be able to work together. And this is one of the few places in the world where all Buddhists come together and work together. And it's such a nice thing when that happens. It feels right, you know? And we try to have that diversity in the monastic community. If you go to Dhammasara Monastery, it's very, very diverse in the monastics at Dhammasara Monastery. All kinds of backgrounds, the monks also, quite a lot of different backgrounds. So we're trying to have that throughout all the aspects of the monastery. So that's what happens at lunchtime. All these people come. And after lunch, you go back to your duty, and you have the whole afternoon and evening just for yourself to meditate and to translate a little bit, to read the suttas. Whatever you think is appropriate for your spiritual practice, you do then in the evening, in the afternoon. Some people do a bit of extra work in the monastery, this is basically what we do. And then a couple of times a week we have a Dhamma talk, everyone comes together, and once a fortnight we have the recitation of the Patimokkha, which is the monastic rules. We recite those, recite by heart, 227 rules for the monks, 311 rules for the bhikkhunis. Yeah? Can you recite all the Bikini rules? Can you recite all the Bikini rules? Can Newton. Yeah? By heart? You cannot run, okay. We have some nuns in Paris who can recite all the rules by heart, actually. It's pretty impressive when you hear that. So especially some of the beginner rules are very long. Yeah? They're very kind of very large. It takes a very good memory to learn those. That's what we do. So does that sound good? You want to become a monk or a nun now? This is the chance, yeah, this is the opportunity. That's what we do. Very simple life. But what I really love about monastic life is incredibly meaningful. I wouldn't want to do anything else apart from being a monk. Apart from when your kind of desires for the worldly desires, sometimes they sometimes the monastic life, occasionally it is not kind of great. Of course it goes up and down. But in the big picture of things, it's incredibly meaningful because you feel that you're doing something that actually has real value. You are developing yourself in a very profound way. You're changing yourself inside, yeah, gradually getting rid of all of these negative tendencies in the mind, becoming more pure-hearted, becoming more kind, more peaceful, more wise, slowly, slowly, slowly. Yeah, it's such an incredibly beautiful thing. When I look at people in the world, and people who live just for careers or for making money, I feel sorry for them. They might be really, really wealthy and very successful. I still feel sorry for them because I feel they haven't really got a life. Yeah, if that is all you live for, it's empty. There's nothing there. What's the point? Then you die, you can't take anything with you. It's kind of so empty to me. So this is a truly meaningful existence. Doing something of incredible value, something really profound, something that gives happiness not just for yourself, but for a vast number of people around the world. You can imagine when Ajahn Brahm gives a Dhamma talk on a Friday night, there may be 500,000 people who listen to that Dhamma talk around the world. Yeah? Some of his Dhamma talks have been listened to by millions of people, quite literally. And there's something wonderful about that, being able to spread this beautiful Buddhist message to so many people. It's so beautiful. And so it is such an incredibly meaningful life. And that is why I really recommend it. If anyone has any kind of feelings of becoming monastic, I would really recommend this life because it is far more meaningful than any other life you can ever have. Anyway, I'm trying to be a salesman. Am I working? Is it working? Sometimes people think that being a monastic is like for losers, but actually it's all the way around. Anyway, Ajahn Brahm says being a loser is a good thing because you want to lose as much as possible. So regardless, you win. Anyway, next question. Dear Ajahn, if one passes away without being a sotapanna, does all the wisdom gained in this life go to waste in coming lives? Buddha. No, it does not. The quality that we build up in this life, you carry with you to your next life. And in a sense, it's very obvious if you think about it, because the thing that you take with you from one life to the next one is your mind. That's what goes with you. You may lose some of the memories, but the qualities of your mind, the qualities of your heart, if you like it, they are carried on into the future. So if you build up a bright and clear mind, you take that bright and clear mind with you. If you build up wisdom inside of yourself, and that wisdom, that intuitive wisdom, you will take with you also into the future. It is said in the suttas that if you get reborn, for example, in the Deva realm, and then you hear the Devas recite the suttas, you will say, wait a minute, I remember this. Remember this when I was, you know, a Buddhist. Yeah. Wow, it's so beautiful. And then you get drawn back into Buddhism because you recognize it wherever you are reborn in the future. So the best way, if you want to continue to develop in your future life, the best thing you can do is to develop as much as possible in this life. Take your practice as far as possible, understand this teaching as deeply as you possibly can, and then if you are fortunate, you will be able to continue in your next life. Yeah, as long as you don't get reborn in the wrong place. And don't try to avoid Afghanistan, yeah, because it's difficult to get good Buddhist teachings in Afghanistan. There are certain places that are more difficult to get Buddhist teachings than others. I'll give you an example. We have a person in Perth now, he was a Buddhist in Pakistan, yeah, almost as bad as Afghanistan, not quite, but almost as difficult there. And if you are a Buddhist in Pakistan, it's bad news. You have a little daughter, you know, little children, they talk about everything, yeah? So they had all of these people coming to the house one day for some kind of occasion. And this little daughter said, "My father, he's a Buddhist." And people looked at him, yeah? And from that moment, they knew that he was a Buddhist. He had an incredible problem, and he was basically chased out of Pakistan. He had to flee the country. And because he was already a Buddhist, because he already was connected to the Buddhist Society of WA, he fled to Australia. And eventually we were able to get him a refugee visa, because the evidence was so strong that, you know, there was a big problem here. Very clear evidence. There was a fatwa against him in Pakistan, all of these things. It really matters where you've been reborn. Yeah? This is not just a theoretical thing, it actually matters. It matters quite a bit. So get reborn in, what is a good place? Hong Kong, is that a bigger place to reborn in?
Norway.
Norway. No, I don't know. In Norway, you just get ice and snow, you know? That's for sure. Actually, maybe the snow will disappear as well now. I don't know. Just don't worry about where you get reborn. Just do the right thing, then come up. We'll kind of look after the rest of it. Okay, so there you are, so you keep your wisdom, yeah? So build it up to the max and take it with you to your next life. Okay, next one. What are dreams? Do we need to think of our last night's dreams? Thank you for your advice. What are dreams? Dreams are just papancha. Papancha is like proliferation, yeah? Things happening in your mind. And there are some people who say you can kind of look at the dreams and you can understand yourself from your dreams. Maybe. I don't know. I think in Buddhism they don't really have much effect. There's not really much point to dreams. There are some. If the more clear your mind is, the less you dream at night. And sometimes you have this beautiful night's sleep where your mind is completely empty. You wake up in the morning fresh, energized, ready for the next day because your meditation is going well or whatever. So ideally, you have as little dreams as possible. But occasionally, even people with very powerful minds have dreams. And sometimes these dreams can be like prophetic dreams. Yeah, I know a few people who have these kind of prophetic dreams. They have a vision in the dream, and then a short time later, exactly that thing they saw in the dream actually happens in real life. These things seem to be possible, but most of the time dreams are just rubbish, that's what I would say. Things happening, the mind trying to work things out, yeah, trying to kind of sort out what is useful and what is not. So I wouldn't worry too much about dreams. If you want to have nice dreams, do metta meditation. If you have a lot of kindness to people around you, you won't have any nightmares. You will never have bad dreams, you will attempt to sleep well. And you wake up in the morning feeling good, feeling energized, ready for the next day's work, whatever it is. Metta is very useful. Dinanda, you mentioned about reflecting on the sitting before we end a sitting session. Can you explain a bit more about it? How do we do it? What do we reflect on? Thank you very much. Okay, so the idea at the end of the meditation is to ask yourself whether it has been successful or not. And sometimes the meditation goes well, and when it goes well, ask yourself why that is the case. And why is it that today I feel really peaceful after meditation? Yesterday it didn't work at all, today I feel really peaceful. And as you start to think in this way, you will start to uncover the causes for good meditation practice. You will realize that it depends on the state of mind you have when you start out. You will realize that you have to let go of certain things in a certain way. You will realize it has to do with your attitude, yeah, how you think about things. You have a very positive attitude, certainly the meditation goes well. And when you see this, you will know what you have to do at the beginning to put yourself in the right frame of mind to make the meditation work. This is what it is about. Yeah, this is kind of the point of reflection to enable you later on to use that reflection, use that information to enhance your meditation experience. And there's two things that we will see. One is the ability to let go, and the other one is the right kind of perception, the right kind of attitude. Both of those two things are important for meditation to work. This is one of the reasons why the death contemplation can come in handy, because if you just sometimes all you have to do is bring to mind the idea of death, bam, you let go of everything, because you know that death implies everything has to go. And because we can die at any time, now is the time to let go. Yeah, there is no other time. So this is what we do, and sometimes you can also use your bad meditations as well. You come to the end, the meditation was really wrong. Why was it wrong? Why did it work out? That too can be useful sometimes, if you reflect back. So the idea here is to become a master of your own practice, so you understand how meditation works. You don't rely so much on a teacher. You become responsible for your own success and or lack of success in a meditation. This is the idea. Okay. Okay, here I am. Will I be in breach of the five precepts of killing if I put a serious ill pet to euthanasia? This is a very good question, and it really depends on the situation. Yeah, it depends on whether the animal wants to die or not. If the animal wants to die, then there isn't really any problem, because the problem with killing is that you are depriving someone of something they want. If someone wants to live, you kill them. It's bad, precisely because they want to live. But if someone wants to die, and they have good reasons for that, for example, we talk these days about assisted suicide. Someone has come to the very end of their life, but they don't want to live anymore. They have gone through all the medical checks, they're not depressed, they do this with good understanding. I just got an email a few days ago from a close friend in the UK, an Englishman. His wife is actually from Hong Kong, that's true. His wife is from Hong Kong. And he has this illness that gradually deteriorates the body. I think it's called motor neuron disease or something like that. Maybe similar to Stephen Hawking's had, something to that effect. And his body is just gradually getting worse and worse and worse. Yeah? After a while, you can't walk anymore. After a while, you just have to lie there. You can't do anything. Yeah? And he has decided when his life comes to a point that he can't really have a quality of life anymore, he will use this assisted suicide. So he asked me for my opinion. And I said, well, if you are use this wisely, use it in a good way, then I cannot see that you're doing any bad karma by doing this. Why? Because karma has to do with our intentions. If you're coming from compassion and kindness and wisdom, by definition, you cannot make bad karma. Karma is not in the act, karma is in the intention. So this is what I told him. So now he has decided to go ahead. He's already booked an appointment. There is this place in Switzerland called Dignitas, which is a place that helps you with these kind of things when the point comes. I think it is a very brave decision. But I told him to be careful. Make sure you know what you're doing. And don't just do, these things should be done after a lot of reflection. Make absolutely sure you know what you're doing. It should not be hasty decisions. And when it comes to a pet, it's a similar kind of idea that matter for pets as well. Yeah? What does the animal want? And if you have a feeling that the animal is ready to die and doesn't really want to live anymore, if that is a feeling you have, then it may be the right time to do it. Ajahn Brahm says that, you know, when a pet is about to die, you should ask your pet. If you have a close connection to your pet, you ask your pet, would you like to, are you had enough of this life? Would you like to die? And you get the feeling that the pet wants to die. Sometimes that feeling is right. Sometimes you get the feeling, no, the pet wants to live. If the pet wants to live, then ideally you should not euthanize the pet, because then that is where the bad karma comes in. You're doing the wrong thing. But try to feel the situation, what feels right. And very often that intuition, if you come from a clear mind, not a mind of desire, mind of anger, a clear mind, often the intuition is going to be very accurate. Yeah? You're going to feel what feels right. So go, try to go with that. And if you go like that, you're not going to go very wrong anyway. Yeah, you're trying your very best to be wise, to be compassionate. If you try your very best, you're not going to make any very bad decisions, guaranteed. So you don't have to worry too much about it. So something like that, yeah, and then hopefully that should be okay in most circumstances. Okay. Ooh, okay, but hurry up a little bit. Let's see what comes next. Imagine Brahmadi, although many people have done so many good things and have so many good qualities, they don't think they are good enough and sometimes even feel guilty or something. Feel good, says he. I'm not sure, maybe that is guilty. Will this mind take a major role on getting into deep meditation and the quality of rebirth? It will affect you a little bit, but very often when you come to the end of your life, it is a different thing, because when you come to the end of your life, you will review your life, you will look at your life in kind of like a big picture of things, and you will have a rough idea of whether you have lived well or not. So when you look back like that, you will see things with more perspective. Sometimes you will then realize, actually, you have lived a pretty good life, even though sometimes you may feel guilty or bad, maybe because society isn't really appreciating you properly or whatever. You often, when you come to the end of your life, that's when you get the real perspective on what is going on, and then the good karma will take you forward. But it is still good to develop that feeling in this life. Really look at your life, appreciate the good things that you're doing. Don't become arrogant, of course. That's not the point of becoming arrogant about things. If you live well, it's good to appreciate that. If you're keeping the five precepts, if you go on meditation retreats, if you're trying to be kind and caring to other people, it means you're already doing really well. And you have every right to be content and happy about that. Don't judge yourself too hard for the mistakes you make. Understand that you are also conditioned. Sometimes we can't help ourselves from getting angry. Yeah, you have all these things going on in Hong Kong. Of course you get angry sometimes. Don't get angry with yourself for getting angry. If you do that, you make it worse. Yeah, you get angry because you get angry. Then you get angry because you get angry because you get angry. And it keeps on like that. And you can be infinitely angry because of that, ultimately. So instead of doing that, okay, I get angry sometimes when there's something. It's okay. It's not a big deal. But I'm leaning in the right direction. You forgive yourself for your weaknesses. It's all right. We all have weaknesses. In this way, you can appreciate for yourself. And remember to how hard it is sometimes for people to appreciate their own good qualities. And when you know that, encourage your fellow Buddhists, when you see something good, and encourage them and tell them, wow, I really appreciate you. You're such a wonderful Kalyanamita. You have all these beautiful qualities. And sometimes people will be very touched when they hear that, because normally we're not told how many good qualities we have. Normally we are told all the defects we have. This is kind of how life usually works. But tell people all the good qualities. I really appreciate your friendship because you are such a good friend. Really, all of these years, what a wonderful thing it is to have a friend like you. And you are going to touch people in a deep way. And this is a wonderful thing to do. And especially when people are dying, is a good time to remind people of these things. Okay. I do not agree on the police's violence and brutality of the Hong Kong protesters. However, as a taxpayer, I have to fulfill my responsibility to pay the salary tax to the government, which in turn, the government will spend money on the police to equip themselves and buy harmful tear gas, etc. I really don't want to support the government, but it seems like I have no choice. As a consequence, do I bear the karma of indirectly harming the Hong Kong protesters? Any advice on what I should do? No, you don't bear any responsibility. you pay your taxes because the taxes go to so many different things. In the end, it is the Hong Kong government who has to kind of bear any responsibility on any violence that happens in Hong Kong. Yeah? They are the ones. You are doing your duty as a citizen, which is the tax money goes to a large number of causes. The police is only going to be a small part of that. And really, you have no say in that distribution of things. You know, if you have the intention, I'm going to pay my taxes so the government can pay the police force, they can really get those protesters, then you're making bad karma. But if you think, I will pay my taxes because it is my duty, and the government has to decide, you're not going to have any bad karma. But if you think that your money should go to oppressed people, of course, you have some bad karma there. So you don't have to worry about that. That is, remember, karma is about intention. Why you do things. That is kind of the ultimate ground of karma. So look at your intention. Your intention is pure and you're okay. There's nothing to worry about. Also questions about this current political situation in Hong Kong, which is probably a good thing. Dear Ajahn, I am confused. Okay, welcome to the club. Yeah, everyone is confused pretty much. Sometimes when I look at the statue of the Buddha, I have a deep feeling of sadness and sorrow instead of joy. It also happens when I read some of the sutras. Any reason? Thank you. Well, the reason sometimes is that the spiritual path is about giving up certain things to enable you to carry on the spiritual path. And the giving up of things can often be difficult. Yeah? Whenever something has to be given up, it can feel that you are giving up something important to you. And that can sometimes feel like sadness. Sometimes you may become a monastic, you may feel a bit sad to begin with because you're giving up your family, you're giving up all these other things. You may feel, am I sure about this? Because you're not entirely sure about the spiritual practice, it makes you feel sad that perhaps you have given up something without getting anything in return. That can sometimes be the reason. So this is something that sometimes maybe you have to go through. And I apologize for reading all these sad sutras. Yeah, they're pretty in your face. Yeah, these sutras, I really have to admit, they're really in your face. I'm not trying to traumatize you. I'm trying more to kind of get you to see a little bit about how the Buddha viewed the world. So just don't take it too seriously. Yeah, if you take it too seriously, it becomes even more sad. Instead of taking it too seriously, just allow it to, okay, interesting, let me not kind of commit suicide because of this. But if you commit suicide because of this, I might go to jail, right? So please don't commit suicide because of this. But instead, just think about it. Allow it to gradually seep in and see what it does to you. And if you take these things in the right way, they will become very powerful in your spiritual practice. If they don't make any sense to you, just leave them aside. You don't have to take these things on board. Do the things that make sense to you. There's a lot in Buddhism that is all about happiness and joy. Practice metta, practice compassion to other people, just be kind. And these things are really positive regardless of what you do with your life. Yeah? These other things are more kind of optional additions if you really want to take the Buddhist path a long way. Yeah? So that is what I would recommend. Don't do too much because then it makes you sad. Find the right balance there. Okay. Dear Ajahn, why do we vow? You mean vow or vow? What does it mean? What do we think? What do we think when we vow? Also, what does this chant on the whiteboard mean? Thank you, Ajahn. You probably mean vow. Yeah, it looks like you have a V there. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I'll assume that you mean vow instead of vow. So, what's the point of vowing? The point of bowing is just to accept that there are certain things in life really worth bowing to. There are certain things in life that are so beautiful and so powerful and so nourishing and so productive of happiness and contentment in the world that they are really worth bowing down to. the Buddha's teaching is one of those things really worth bowing down to, because it's so beautiful. When you bow down to the Buddha's teaching, what you are saying is that you're saying that there's something in life that is kind of larger than us. There's something we can take as a refuge, somewhere we can go when we need good advice. This is what the Buddha's teaching is all about. You bow down to these wonderful values of kindness, compassion, wisdom, peace, all of these things. That's what you bow down to, because the Buddha symbolizes all of these things. The majority of people in the world, they bow down to money, they bow down to fame, they bow down to all of these superficial things, and they will bow by bowing down. I mean that you know, when you are around the right kind of people, you become very nice and kind of think, you do the right thing because you want to impress the right kind of people or whatever. That's what we bow down to. But it's superficial. It doesn't have any deep value. It's not going to take you very far. Bow down to something meaningful then. And when you have a little bit of humility in the presence of these wonderful values, it means you're more likely to develop them. If you are proud or arrogant or whatever, much more difficult to develop these beautiful values. If you have a degree of humility about yourself, then you're willing to suspend your judgment, you're willing to take on board these teachings in a deeper way, and then develop these qualities in your heart. So bowing is beautiful. What do you feel like when you bow? When I bow, it feels good. It feels really nice. It feels like, it feels like you are purifying the mind, basically. Whenever you bow, some of the conceit goes away, some of the arrogance goes away. There's less sense of self in there. That's nice. You're emptying out some of this rubbish inside of you. It's nice to empty out a bit of rubbish. Just like when you go back to your room, you throw out the rubbish in your little rubbish basket, and you throw out the rubbish from your mind, kind of throw out the rubbish out of your brain. Brainwashing, that's what it is. Brainwashing, throw out the rubbish from your mind. And so this is what it is about. So feel what it feels like. And if it feels good, bow. If it feels bad, don't bow. There's no obligation, you don't have to bow if you don't want to bow. But if it feels nice, then do it. What does the chanting mean? Arahant, Sama, Sambuddha. Arahant means like the Arahant, the fully. Arahant is like someone who has reached full awakening. This is one of the words for the Buddha. Sama. Arahant, Sama, Sambuddha. Sambuddha is like, another word for the Buddha. It means, fully awakened. Buddha means awakened. Sama is like rightly or fully, it's the fully awakened one. Bhagava is like an ancient Indian word which means like a lord or something like that. It is a word that is used for anyone who is a special spiritual power. Buddha, Buddha, awakened one. Bhagavata, same thing again. Abhimadevi, Abhimadevi means like you bow, you bow down or you respect or something like that. The first one is like paying respect to the Buddha. That's the first one. And that's why we bow down at the end of that one. Next one, svakato. Svakato means su. Akato, su is well. Akato means explained or expounded. So it means well expounded. And what is well expounded is the Dhamma. Dhamma is the third word. Svakato bhagavata dhammo. So the Dhamma is well expounded. Bhagavata by the Buddha. That's what it means. Dhamma namasami. I respect the Dhamma. Namasami. If you go to India, everyone says namaste. This is the same word as namaste. In the ancient sutras, we have the same word as they use in India in the present day. It's still there. So it means I respect the Dhamma, or I honor the Dhamma, or something like that. Supatipanno means well practiced. Pratipanna is to practice. Su is well practiced. And what is well practiced is the Savakasango, the third word. Savakasango is the Sangha, the community of the Savaka. Savaka is a disciple. It literally means someone who hears. Savaka is a hearer because they hear the Dhamma. These are the disciples. So the disciples of the Buddha are well practiced. Bhagavata means of the Buddha. So this Savakasango are the noble disciples. Sangham Namami, it means I respect to honor that those Aryan noble disciples of the Buddha. What do you think? Does that sound good? It's quite nice, yeah. So this is what you bow down to when you bow down. You bow down to something really worthy of bowing down. These are qualities that we're all aspiring to, but we haven't really fully acquired yet. That's why you kind of bow down to stuff you say, I aspire for these things in a way. Okay. Oh, time is going really fast, so I'm going to finish off this one in a few minutes, I hope. Dear Ajahn, are the devas in the jhana realms constantly in jhana? In the sutra, they seem to be able to talk and communicate, so I guess they are not in jhana. But then why is it called the jhana realm, sir? I think they are mostly in jhana. Yeah, so when the devas in the jhana realms, they tend to be in the jhana state. So when you pass away from the human realm, if you go into a deep state of meditation, you get reborn in the jhana realm. And then if you are a noble disciple, as soon as you come out of the jhana, you parinibbana, you enter nibbana as a consequence. So it's called the jhana anagami. It's you find it in the suttas in a few places. Occasionally, maybe they come out for a moment and then maybe bang, they go back in again. Possibly, I'm not sure about that. But most of the time, they will be in the jhana. There are some exemptions, and those exemptions are if you go reborn in the pure abodes, these are the abodes or the realms of the anagamis, the non returners, and they don't seem to be in jhana always. So they can kind of come back and maybe visit us. Yeah, if you see some kind of high powered Deva, maybe that is Deva from the pure abodes, I'm not sure. So most of the time we say yes, occasionally maybe not, depending also on the kind of level of jhana we're talking about. Okay, in Ajahn, what is forgiveness? If someone has done me wrong, I forgive him, but would not have any further communication with that person. Is that true forgiveness? It's a good question, yeah? It's a very nice question. I like this kind of question. Very practical, straight to the point. What is forgiveness? Forgiveness means that you give up the hurt that you feel inside because someone has done something wrong against you. That is real forgiveness. Yeah, you give up the hurt. You say, okay, it's okay. You can do whatever you want to do. It is really your problem. It's got nothing to do with me. I forgive you. I let it go. You give up that hurt. So the main purpose of forgiveness is not so much that the other person becomes happy because of it, but you become happy. You release the problem inside of you. So forgiveness, the main beneficiary of forgiveness is not the other person. You are the main beneficiary of forgiveness. How can we forgive? And the way to forgive, again, is just to remember that we're all a bit like robots. We're all programmed, we're all conditioned to what we are. The problem is, it feels like we have free will, and that is the problem. That is the delusion. We don't really have free will. We are just running on all of these conditions in our life. Is there a little bit of free will? It's kind of, maybe there is, maybe there isn't. I'm not sure. I don't think there is. But even if there is, the vast majority, we are conditioned into who we are and what we are doing. So once you understand that everyone is conditioned, people don't really have a choice in what they're doing, how can they be responsible? And if they're not really responsible, then instead of judging them badly, you forgive them and you even have compassion for them because they are doing bad things, even though they actually probably want to do good things. I think everybody wants to be kind. Is there anyone here who doesn't want to be kind? Most people want to be kind, yeah, because we know that kindness leads to happiness. Only fools actually want to be, not kind. And still, even though everyone here wants to be kind, everyone here wants to have metta all the time, are you able to have metta all the time? Anyone here is able to have metta all the time? No one. Yeah. Maybe the Buddha, but the Buddha can't answer. So, he's sitting quietly, he's very wise, sitting quietly behind there. So we cannot. Yeah, even if we want to, we can't. Why is it that we can't? Because the conditioning is so strong. As soon as you read about the rise, how come we get upset? Yeah. Why? Because the conditioning is so strong. You know that probably better to be compassionate and helping, but you just can't do it. This is the conditioning. This is why it is so hard. So once you understand that, once you understand your own conditioning being so strong, other people have exactly the same problem. Often other people have an even greater problem. Then we can forgive, because you realize it is not their fault, it is their conditioning. This is how you forgive. Forgiveness isn't that difficult if you just think in the right way. If you have no further communication with somebody, actually, you can't forgive and also have no communication. Yeah? Because sometimes you know that some people are so difficult to be with, that if you are around them, you're just going to hurt around them. Then it's okay not to be around them. You don't have to put yourself in harm's way. You don't have to allow other people to abuse you. It's okay to say, okay, I forgive you, but also I really cannot be around you. It's okay, I understand we have a problem, but I cannot be around you. It's just too difficult. It's too painful for me. That's also okay. So it is still true forgiveness. You have to learn to look after yourself. You have to learn to know the limitations of what you're able to do. It's okay to say no sometimes. Okay. Next one. I've only got one more to go, so we're coming to the end. Okay, we always say, see the reality as it is. When we are in meditation, the eye sense doesn't really work as the way it usually is. So shouldn't it be feel reality as it is instead of see reality? Okay, you can say that, feel reality as it is instead of see reality. I think see there is not really meant literally, it is more meant metaphorically, seeing as it feeling, similar kind of idea. So feeling reality or understanding reality, the Pali word is yata, bhuta, jnana dasana, and jnana means knowledge, dasana means seeing, but seeing in Pali doesn't just mean seeing with the eye, it means seeing with the mind. So in that sense, it's more like feeling, it's an inner kind of seeing, an inner quality that is meant by this. So seeing reality as it actually is. So, okay, that's a good point. Last question for tonight, I'm happy to say, because time is getting late now, so last one. If life is suffering, why is it not good to end life? Thank you for your kind advice. The reason is because, unfortunately, you get reborn. So, life is suffering, and suddenly you're back where you started off. That is why it is not a good idea. So instead, you try to make an end of suffering, and the way to do that is to practice the spiritual path. That is how, what you're supposed to do. This is why committing suicide is not a good idea. I would never recommend it, except in very special circumstances, where you have no quality of life, you cannot really practice anymore. In such circumstances, it may be okay, depending on the situation, depending on how you do it. But generally speaking, it's not a good idea to commit suicide. But it's not always wrong. We shouldn't judge people if they commit suicide. If people commit suicide, usually it's because of a lot of pain inside. What really matters in life is how we live, not how we die. If you live well, then things are going to go well for you, regardless of how you die usually. Okay, gee. So, enough for tonight. Again, have a good night's rest. I will be back here, hopefully tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock. So if you want to come out and meditate tomorrow morning, please do so. We'll see you then. Now let's do the Arahant Samma Sambuddha again together.
サールサールサール